Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, perhaps one that influenced their own work. Today, I'm so excited to have the actor, writer, director, Bria Grant here today. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Hot.
I'm not so familiar with your voice, but like I'm familiar with it from your podcast, but it's like right in my ears right now. I'm really enjoying it.
Oh, great.
It's a good voice.
Oh, thanks.
It's good. You got a voice for radio.
I'll tell my mother because it's exactly her voice.
Is it really?
Yeah. Every woman in my family has the exact same voice.
When you would answer the phone when you were a kid, like would they be like, Martha or whatever her name is? I don't know what your mother's
name
is.
Yeah, I'd be like, Kitty? Is this Kitty?
Yeah.
Everyone thought I was Kitty. They still do. So for Bria, I want to make sure everyone's very familiar with her if you're not. So please let me give you a synopsis of Bria's career. This is your life. Bria Grant is a native Texan who earned a degree in American studies before venturing into acting. As a Texan, it's only right that one of her first roles was a short run playing a junkie woman on the show Friday Night Lights. Love that show. From there, Bria went on to embody a number of different roles in television, including Daphne Millbrook on Heroes and Ryan Chambers on Dexter, before she went off and co-wrote, directed, and starred in the film Best Friends Forever with recent Switchblade guest Vera Miao.
Oh, what did Vera do? Am I allowed to interrupt my own?
You can. Okay. Vera did The Matrix.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that makes sense.
Lots of philosophy talk. It was great.
Yeah.
So Best Friends Forever, just a refresher, that film follows two friends with a lot of tension between them who embark on a road trip at the absolute worst time when a nuclear disaster is approaching. Now, Bria is a producer on the Emmy-nominated Netflix series EastSiders, which just started production on its fourth season. And you can see her in a bunch of films like Dead Awake, Beyond the Gates, Dead Night, Sleep No More, tons and tons of movies. Look at her IMDb and just check those out. And a bunch that are going to be premiering in 2018, 2019, probably running through the festival circuit.
Yeah.
Bria is at the festivals a lot, I think.
You know, I go when I can. I mean, I'm mostly a broke actress, so I go like when I like am like, okay, I can like spare the money to like go and like out to eat for this number of days. Truly, I'm like, well, if I bring a bunch of like Cliff Bars,
exactly,
then I'll just like eat those all day and then I don't have to eat out. Like that's like, for those of you who want to be an actor, like this is your life. This is your life as a successful actor.
You will see her walking around Fest with a brown bag with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
It's not a lie. I totally do it. But I also just do that everywhere I travel. I always have food.
Have done it as well.
Yeah.
Look,
listen.
Budgeting is part of life when you're
really
an indie artist. On top of that, I should also say that Bria is a co-host of the Maximum Fun podcast, Reading Glasses.
That's true.
So if you love books, that is a podcast you should definitely be checking out. So Bria chose a really great film that I had not seen in a long time and which I was so happy to revisit from one of my favorite directors. She chose Basket Case.
Yes, I did.
Can you tell me a little bit about why?
You know, I thought about this morning because I knew you were going to ask me, and I was like, why did I choose this movie? a lot of the movies I think I would have chose, a lot of people have done. But I do think this movie is very fun. I'm not going to say it's not problematic, but it is very fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I watched this. It's like a real weird personal journey for me, like my career. And I think I watched this, and we could get into this later, but around the time where I had done a bunch of television, but I hadn't really stepped my, like, I started in television, which is strange, I think, for a lot of people. Like, one of my first jobs was, like, a guest star on a television show. That was, like, literally one of my first jobs. And then I started doing more and more indie stuff, and a lot of stuff happened, and I did a couple of indie movies and, like, fired my agent because I was like, I'm going to do indie movies. And it was, like, this big thing, big, like, choice for me. And I was hanging out with my brother in New York at the time, and he was like, you should watch this movie, Basket Case. And I just, like, watched it on YouTube, and I was like, you can make a movie for no money. That's amazing. It's not like television where you need millions of dollars every day just to make this, like, fucking TV show. And so I think that's part of what really stuck with me, where I was like, truly, I don't know how much they made this movie for. You may know this.
$32,000, I believe.
Okay, that's
between $32,000 and $35,000.
Right. Which, you know, no matter which way you cut it, is really inspiring to me. And I think that is part of it. Also, it's really a crazy movie. That's the other reason I chose it. It's just like, it's a wacky idea that, you know, I love that people are like, no, but we're on board for this. We're on board for you carrying your twin brother in a basket. I don't think that's giving anything away.
But. No, I'm pretty sure that's it. And in fact, this would be a good time to say that for those who have not seen Basket Case, today's episode will give you some spoilers, but that should not stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to watch Basket Case now, I invite you to do so and come back to us. And I'm assuming you're back to us, so let's introduce Basket Case with a little synopsis. Written and directed by Frank Henenlotter for release in 1982, Basket Case stars Kevin Van Hentenrick as Dwayne, a wide-eyed, jumpy guy who arrives fresh to New York City with a backpack and a rather large basket in his hands. Dwayne rents a room in a typical seedy New York building and befriends a nice prostitute next door named Casey, played by the lovely Beverly Bonner. But Dwayne's not the chipper small-town guy we think he is, because inside that basket is Dwayne's conjoined twin brother, who was violently separated from him when the two were teenagers. Bilal is his name, and he's essentially a head with a blob body and two clawed and deformed hands. Also, very sharp teeth and superhuman strength, which he developed from being so angry from being separated from his brother.
Oh, is that how he got that?
There's like one line where I watched it and I was just like, oh... Well, they explain
that. It's good to know, yeah.
Dwayne and Bilal have come to the city to murder every doctor who participated in the surgery that separated them. They knock off the docs one by one, with Dwayne setting an angry Bilal on them. But their fruitful brotherly partnership is threatened when Dwayne meets a pretty lady at one of the doc's offices and goes on a date with her. Bilal, threatened by Dwayne's new friendship, lashes out by killing someone not on the doc list. Dwayne worries he might not be able to control his brother and confides in Casey that all that's been going on. Casey becomes Belial's next target, but she escapes. But others just aren't so lucky, and Dwayne is helpless against the murderous brother he loves. It is.
It's a good synopsis.
It is a love story.
It's about, you know, families forever, you know? It's about siblings, family love.
Yeah.
codependent relationships at its core.
Yeah. You know, I mean, that's one of the things that I love. If you listen to interviews or watch interviews with the star, Kevin Van Hentenrick, which I love his fucking last name, he is one cool dude. Very interesting, very sweet.
I was watching with a girlfriend of mine, and I was like, I feel like this guy would live in Silver Lake, and I would have gone on a date with him.
Yeah.
Like, he's, like, very, like, attractive in that kind of, like, hipstery, like, floofy hair, like, you know, ill-fitting shirt sort of way.
Yeah. I love him, and I think this movie actually succeeds in part because he's so committed to this role.
Totally.
He's so committed that, in fact, when they were filming it, Henenlotter questioned some stuff that Kevin was doing, like, some choices that he was making, and Kevin had to be like, no, you need to trust me. Like with an actor, you know, like, look at what's going on. And Henenlotter is like, oh, all right, whatever you want to do. Like, the way that he approached his character was to have complete empathy for these brothers and to create two separate characters in his head, one being Bilal, the angry one, and one being the innocent of Dwayne, that he would kind of alternate playing. Because he wanted to blur the identity so much between these two brothers that they felt, you know, that they felt they were the same person, that sometimes he would... you know, switch personas.
Right, because they were conjoined twins, but also they had a psychic link. So
yes.
That makes sense. They're kind of like the same person. I mean, yeah, I think he did that really well. And, like, look, as an actor, like, you end up in these situations where you're like, I guess this is what I wanted to do with my life. Like, when you're in these, like, movies where you're like, why did I do that movie? And, like, I don't know the answer to that. But then you're like, I guess you either commit to the moment, and you, in the example of him, he's just, like, speaking to, like, a hunk of plastic and, like, you know, crying at it, or, like, you know, all these things where you're like, how do you even put yourself, like, how does the, you know, acting method that I trained for in college, like, affect this, like, this moment? And you kind of, like, have to either commit or, like, quit your job, because, like, he does an amazing job, and it's the only reason the movie holds together.
Yeah.
Half those people, I feel like they just were like, do you want to be in a movie? And they, like, gave them a role. Like, it was, like, so, most of them were not great.
Yeah.
And he's so amazing.
It's a really... And you also have an aunt who's...
Yes.
Who is the one who nurtures them, who you know, is the kind of goodness, the core of the film, where it's just like, no, you two are mine, and I'll keep you safe, and I'll keep you protected, and, you know, I'll read you all stories and that kind of thing. And it's very sweet.
I'm not going to ask you what really happened. I know that you and your brother have gone through hell. Everyone thinks Belial is dead now, and we'll let them. It's safer that way. But I'm here now to take care of you. Both of you.
It is very sweet. I think the moment where she's, like, rocking Belial back and forth is, like, really touching.
Yeah, it is.
And very committed. Again, an actor who just straight up committed to rocking this, like, puppet of plastic back and forth and, like... Like, so on multiple sets I've been on, I've had, like, fake babies, you know? And so you have this baby, and they're like, look at the baby. Like, you love it. And it's just a piece. It's just, like, a piece of plastic.
You're like, okay, look at the baby like you love it. What does that mean?
Yeah. And, you know, you love this baby. And, like, it's like, you're a baby. And, like, these are, it's like, I don't know if you've seen, like, set babies, but they are so creepy looking. They're not, like, normal baby dolls. They're, like, I don't know. They're horrifying. They're horrifying because they look almost real, but like they're that weird uncanny valley where it's like they're like, you know, their features don't make sense and their bodies are like, you know, jelly. And so like,
because they have to kind of wiggle.
They have to wiggle. Yeah, they have to like move around and they have to have like a heft to them. Otherwise, you're like swinging the baby around.
Yeah.
So I mean, like these roles are not easy to do. And so anytime I believed anyone in this movie, I'm always like, good job, you. I believed that you've really felt for Belial in this moment.
And, you know, all the actors that they got for this movie, well, the actual actors, not the non-actors, they all came from the American Academy of Dramatic Arts in New York. Because one woman who was working on the set worked there and was just like, oh, I'll just hook you guys up with all of these actors who are in New York and who want to do something.
See, that's great. And this, I think, is what is really... inspiring about Basket Case.
I love this. I love where this is going, where it started.
Is that, you know, sometimes the greatest, like, coolest things come from just a bunch of people getting together who just want to, like, fucking go do something. Because I do think in this industry, we wait a lot for the phone to ring or we wait to give us that, someone to give us that money to do something. And a lot of, like, really good art comes from, you know, really, projects that have restraints, things that like only have a certain amount of money or they only have a certain number of days to shoot it. And you always hear these stories, and maybe this movie didn't become, you know, the next like Apocalypse Now or something, but it did. It does have its own story that it actually tells in completion, and I think is really, really fun. It's a super fun, weird story.
Yeah, and you know, this one has its place in cinematic history, too. It was restored by MoMA in, I think, 2013.
Uh-huh.
Because it really kind of helped kick off the New York grindcore movement that was happening in the early 80s. So it wasn't quite grindcore, but it was in that kind of vein. It lived within different genres, you know, exploitation, sometimes horror. Henan Lotter still doesn't consider himself a horror director.
Sure, that's fine. Which is okay. Like, this was his like drama. This was his sibling drama.
he believes that there. I think he's not offended by that, but he knows that he was making exploitation. And he wasn't making horror because he wasn't trying to scare anyone.
Mm.
Like he never felt like he was trying to scare anyone with Belial, for instance.
Interesting.
It was just like, oh, it's just an interesting creature that we've created, this human with sharp teeth, you know, with
right. It's like more, I guess it could be a revenge tale. Like what, I mean, it's just like what other genres will it fall into?
I think it could be a revenge tale. I don't know.
Well, it's a great revenge tale because And it's a well-set-up movie because you have, you know, these three people they're going after.
Yeah.
And, like, that's what they're trying to achieve. So, like, that's the goal. And you know where it's going. It's not like – I feel like sometimes I watch movies of, like, this level and I'm like, what is happening? What are they trying to do now? Like,
yeah.
And I always know what their goal is in this movie. They're going to kill these doctors who, for some reason, illegally removed – We don't know why this happened, really, but these doctors were there, and one was a vet. So one was a veterinarian.
One was a veterinarian, yes, which we find out later.
But why not? You know, I mean, who else is going to remove this twin?
Yeah,
from this guy's body
randomly and illegally.
Can we go back to the news? So, where did you grow up?
Michigan.
Okay, so when I grew up in Texas, and I remember we went to New York once when I was like five, and I remember thinking it was the scariest place I had ever been. So this would have been like the 80s, like mid 80s.
Yeah, yeah. It was It was grittier then, well
right,
said.
Right. And for me, but I remember my dad was like, gotta be, someone's going to try to mug us on every corner. Like, the taxi drivers, they're crazy, and they're all going to rip us off. And he was, like, really, like, preparing us. And so I remember feeling like I was very brave for going to New York because I was like, because my dad had told me it was crazy, and then we went, and nothing crazy happened. I think saw cats or something. But I when I watched this movie, I'm like, oh, that is what I thought New York was like, where it's, like, it is, like, really grimy and, like, it's, I mean, I wouldn't have known what a porn store was at that time, but, like, you know, it was, like, full of porn stores and people, like, prostitutes and, like, all that kind of stuff, and there's crime everywhere, and there's a guy who's walking around with his brother in a basket, you know, like, all the, and I think that it's, like, a crazy representation of, like, what I thought the big city was like when I was, like, very young from a really tiny town, and it does a good job of that. Like, it was a scary, it was scary to me because there was all the, you never know what could happen, I guess.
Yeah. And there's a really great story of when they're filming that opening, like not the opening scene, but the opening scene of Dwayne being in New York where he's walking down 42nd Street, I believe, Times Square area before Rudy Giuliani cleaned it,
right.
quote unquote,
right.
cleaned it up.
Yeah.
They were driving alongside him in a van with the door open, filming and, you know, just filming anything that went by, and a man ran in and jumped in the van and started like trying to beat them up because he thought that they were I think he thought that they were the local news that were like trying to film his store because there was a news van that had been there earlier.
Oh my God.
And they were like, no, we're making a movie. And he was just like, oh, so sorry. I'm so sorry. And then he just jumped out of the van and they were like, oh, fuck. But, you know, Henan Lotter said that one of the hardest shoots that he ever did was shooting in 42nd Street because of, you know, like this, like you're capturing New York, but New York was chaotic, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you want to film in the action, then it is going to be a little bit of chaos. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to get into some more of Kevin Van Hentenrijk's thoughts on this movie. He's a great guy. Okay, one quick break.
Hello, are you looking for a new comedy podcast? In which case, can I draw your attention to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast? It's a fictional industry podcast for the beef and dairy industries. It won Best Comedy at the 2017 British Podcast Awards, and it features wonderful guests such as Greg Davis.
To my knowledge, it's the only cow circus that's ever existed in this country. In rural Russia, every small town has a cow circus.
Josie Long.
You should have a beef. Have a beef with them. I have a beef with you. I will have a beef with you. Come round my house and I'll have a beef with you.
And Andy Daly.
That virus never existed. There was never any such thing as a mad cow disease. That was all an illusion that Big Lamb came up with.
That's the Beef and Dairy Network podcast. Find us at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts from. And I would recommend starting at episode 1. Bye.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here joined by Bria Grant to talk about Basket Case.
Yeah.
It's good. I'm serious. Frankenhooker is one of my favorite films.
Is it really?
It is. It is in like my top 10, I would say. That's one that he made after Basket Case.
I've only seen bits and pieces of it. It was like playing at someone's house while I was shooting something, and I was like, come in and I'd watch some of it and go back. But I should watch it.
I've been working on a musical version of it for years.
I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, someday. But I have to say, you know, one of the things that sells all of his movies, obviously, is his actors and these people who are just so interesting. Their faces are so interesting. They're so into everything that's happening. And Van Hentenrijk obviously has one of the most interesting, expressive faces of the actors that he's hired. One of the things I thought was interesting from his point of view is that even though they were working on this film for like a year,
right,
and he like put his heart and soul into it and was just like, yeah, let's do it. Hang me from a fire escape. And that's fine. He was actually never sure that the film would ever be finished.
Oh, wow.
He like up until it came out, he was just like really surprised. He's like, oh God, you guys finished it. That's great.
And they're going to make two sequels.
Yeah. And I think that was such an an interesting perspective to have. I don't think like a lot of people know that the actors, when they do this, when they shoot these independent films, you know, you are kind of like go with God attitude where, you know, I'll support you and I hope that you finish this, but I also don't know what's going to happen after that. I mean, how do you deal with that kind of purgatory?
Yeah, and you get burnt a lot. Like, you go and you're like, okay, I'll do this, especially because I do a lot of genre stuff, and so I'll go to this, like, emotional roller coaster of a movie where I go, and I'm, like, crying, and I'm freaking out, and the movie, like, never sees the light of day. For me, I always try to just think, well, that's a good experience, and I always need to get better, so I could just use it as practice that I was, like, paid for instead of paying for. It's funny. Mm-hmm. So when I first saw this movie, this is what like I kind of was going through at the time, where I had just done a bunch of TV, and then I got offered a little indie movie, and I don't know how industry you want me to get, but like it was during pilot season, which was a big thing, probably like
yeah. And pilot season is when a bunch of people actually get jobs, because it's like, you know, the studios are throwing spaghetti at the walls to see which shows are going to take off and which ones they're going to order to season.
Yeah, and even more so like 6 or 7 years ago, I feel like it was even more popular like that, or like there were even more shows going. Like now some networks don't do as many, but I was just coming off of Heroes, and I had an huge, you know, got my fancy agent, my fancy manager, and mm-hmm. I got offered this little indie movie, and they were like, well, you can't take that. It's pilot season. And I was like, I'm an artist. I'm going to take this movie. So I took the movie, and the movie never came out. My agents dropped me because of it. Like, I mean, I obviously did not book a pilot because I went and did this movie in Florida that never saw the light of day. And I was really burnt by it. But at the same time, I feel like I learned a lot on it. I had never done a lead in a movie, and I feel like you should get to do a practice movie at some point.
Yeah.
And like because of some things that happened on that movie, I was able to direct a movie later because of some of the people involved. So it was good. I mean, I do think things come of this. Like if you can like view it in a positive way, which is, you know, the struggle of everyone's career, I think, is just like, how do you not get burnt out in an industry that constantly burns you from every direction? Mm-hmm. Even when you're doing something you really believe in, you're like, because I remember thinking this movie I did in Florida, I was like, this is going to change my life. Like, you know, Heroes, no one will care. This is the movie that people are going to look back and go, wow, she's really great. And like literally has never come out. Not to this day. Like no one has seen it. It played like 2 festivals or something.
Oh, no.
And it was fine. You know, it wasn't like a horrible movie. I also think something happened around that time in the industry where I feel like in the early 2000s, late 90s, if you made a movie and it was decently good, it would go to festivals, but then people got access to filmmaking equipment, and mm-hmm. like there are a lot more movies, and they're just like the numbers, like I think if you look at like how many movies get submitted to Sundance, like after like year 2000, it like jumps dramatically.
Yes.
And people quit paying for movies, and distribution wise, this may be so boring for your listeners, but I think
they're interested in this.
Yeah. I think you can make a movie and you're like, oh, we spent $500,000 on it, and you would always get that money back. And that is just not the case anymore. And I think starting around the time I did that movie, they just couldn't get the money they spent on it, you know, to like,
yeah,
you know, whatever. But yeah, so it is really heartbreaking to see something you really worked on. But I think the whole thing is you just have to like keep moving forward somehow, like against. It's like just like slogging through mud constantly, like every single day.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is like you do see these interesting hits, you know, Basket Case, like Van Hentenrijk didn't even know this was going to be done. And now he's like continually going to represent it places because they did 2 sequels to it, you know.
Right.
And it's you see those probably as an actor and you're like, well, I mean, what if that happened to me? Like, what if this is the one that is the enduring classic.
And you have no idea as an actor. Like, you don't know. Like, because I've gotten to produce more and direct and do things on that side of things, I feel like I have a better sense of, like, what's going to go well, but I really still don't. But as an actor, you, like, do this, and then you walk away, and a year later you hear from them, and they're like, oh, we finished it, and it's in a festival. Like, that's, like, kind of what your life becomes if you do a lot of indie stuff. How well did Basket Case do when it came out?
It actually had a 2.5-year run at the midnight slot at the Waverly.
Holy shit.
And it was doing fine. It was selling out every night, so they had no reason to bring it into the regular theatrical slots to have a proper release.
Wow.
So it did well immediately with lines around the block for 2.5 years until Joe Bob Briggs brought it to a drive-in in Texas, and it had its premiere in Texas.
Wow.
And it was like a kind of shitty drive-in, but and they tried cutting it. They recut it to take out the gory parts, which I think is an interesting thing. Joe Bob Briggs didn't want it to. No one wanted it to be cut. I don't know why they cut it, but they took out the gory parts. And what he was saying when he watched it was just like, it's just mean. Like it became like from being like fun and funny and tongue in cheek and that kind of thing to just being mean when they removed the gory parts. Because the gory parts, you know, there's something like a balance that happens where you understand the tone and you understand that what Hennenlotter is trying to say and trying to do with like the blood squirting, because it's ridiculous, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the, you know, fine line you walk with a lot of these movies. But in any genre movie, you have to have something that allows the audience to, like, breathe. I think maybe not all of them, but there's a few exceptions where I'm like, no, I just didn't breathe that whole movie. It was, like, so, like, yeah, I was so tense. But especially, like, this kind of movie where you just, like, you have to be able to, like, kind of laugh. And the parts you laugh at are when, like, you're getting, like, the doctor's getting gored, you know? And, like, there's just, like, crazy, that guy's crazy hands are going, like, ripping someone's face apart.
Mm-hmm.
He has very strong hands.
Yeah. Or, like, the woman doctor, the vet who has, like, the scalpel sticking out of her face
God,
and she's just screaming.
I know. I like she was a lady doctor, too. She was the big bad, was like a lady vet. Like, what an amazing...
I know. That's what... I have to say, Hennenlotter also really loved working with women.
Yeah. I mean, the woman... I don't know anybody's name, but the woman...
Beverly Bonner, who played Casey.
Amazing. Amazing.
And he loved her. She was performing with Divine in Women Behind Bars and an off-Broadway, obviously. He loved her and went up to her after the show and said, I love you and I need to put you in a movie. And she was like, yeah. Because she'd heard that like a million times.
I'm sure.
You can put me in a movie. And he ended up putting her in all of his movies.
That's amazing. I looked her up because I was like, what else has she been in? And I was like, oh, all of his other movies. And that's kind of it. But she's like just a real classy actress. Like she's like on the screen, like you just like follow her and she's like, I love the way she speaks. Like she enunciates everything.
Yeah, because she's
like
a theater actress.
Way. Yeah,
like,
yeah,
she
yeah.
still she continued to act in theater. It's just that
so
she
good.
Didn't do movies except for with Hennenlotter, really.
Tell you what, why don't you and that picnic basket of yours join me at the back table? I've got some heavy boozing to do, and looks like you can use some good company. Come on.
And she even did she wrote a play about her character Casey. She got permission from Hennenlotter to do a play, so she performed a play.
Where is that play? I have got to find that play.
It was not recorded. I don't think it was, but they clearly were not making a lot of money when like these are labors of love because I don't. Like there are stories where on set where Beverly, all of her friends, all of her actor friends, especially from Women Behind Bars, they are the extras in that bar scene.
Oh, amazing.
And that's a great, amazing bar scene that takes place in an old, and I'm not even sure if that bar is still there. It's like a dungeon, like a gay dungeon bar.
Ooh.
And so they filmed there. And all the people were Beverly's friends, and the crew had to say, "Oh, we're breaking for lunch or something." And then when they would come back, they would put a bunch of like not a bunch, but like maybe two or three half sandwiches around, and be like, "Oh, we forgot to tell you that we had lunch for you," but they didn't really have lunch, but they had to like have an appearance of it. So like these people were like they, like. You know, Beverly got fed, but like no one else.
But
like,
do we think she even got paid at all?
I don't know. That's the thing. I mean, when you're making a movie for like tops $35,000, I don't know. And you know, the locations were I can't remember his last name, but he made every set. Because he lived in a loft in New York, you know, very kind of cheap area then, and he made every single room.
He did?
Yeah. So every, like, and then they struck the set and they remade it for a different room for each time. Like, he was, he made everything in his loft upon Hennenlotter's request, his friend, because he was just like, oh, shit, you got a loft. We got to shoot an asylum scene in here. Don't do anything to this.
I will say that that's the kind of friend where you're like, God, he keeps calling me. He wants to use my loft. Like, exactly. These are like the friends where you're like, please quit calling me. But, you know, you want to help him out.
And... Yeah. And, you know, you've been behind the camera now. Like, yeah. You've made your own feature. And that's something where, was that ever uncomfortable for you when you would have to call in favors from friends or people? Or had you already done so many favors that you're like, hey, come,
I know, right?
Come pay me back.
I know. Like, the number of, like, things I've done for free or people are like, can I use your car? Or, like, random shit people ask you for in L.A. They're like, do you have 3 sandbags? I'm like, yeah, I do have 3 sandbags. You know, like,
exactly.
The random, like,
yeah.
Come get them. Come on. Yeah, I have a lot of trouble calling in favors. But I think that's why this kind of stuff is... Again, because I got my start in a place where, like, you actually did get, like, you get, like, way more money than you probably should,
yes.
Like, you know,
yes.
To do stuff. But I don't mind doing favors for people, and I always try to, like, remind myself of that. Like, I will just say no if I'm, like, can't do something for somebody. And I hope people would just say no to me. But, yeah, it's hard. It's really hard. It's hard to ask for people, see if you can shoot somewhere for free. It's hard to ask people to show up and be like, hey, can you be in the background of the scene? I can't pay you. It will never help your career. You're literally just hanging out with me, like, for the day.
Does it help to be that honest, though? Like, look, this is... Or are you trying to sell it?
Yeah, what do you do? I think I am honest to, like, to a fault when it comes to these things, where I'm just like, I'm sorry, like, I'll apologize. And, like, maybe that's my own thing also that I need to get over, but... I found, like, just saying thank you to people goes a long way.
Yeah.
Like, even if I'm just... Like, especially, like, you know, I just did music, like, a friend's music video. And, like, all it takes is, like, I show up and they're like, oh, thank you for being in this, like, on this super hot day. And I'm like, oh, you're welcome. And, like, just a thank you goes a really long way. The nice thing about my movie is we shot it in Texas. And everyone in Texas was, like, super down with, like, can we shoot an entire scene in your store? And they're like, yeah, when should we shut down? Like, they're just like,
oh, my God.
They're like, what can we give you for free? Like, can you, like, they just, can we be in it for free? And I'm like, you know, it changes the dynamic when you're shooting not in L.A., I think. Makes
yeah,
a really
definitely.
Big difference.
With Hennenlotter, I have to say, the way that he kind of approached this film and all of his films after is... Honestly, just to convince people to want to do it by being so excited.
Yeah, that's great.
And so, you know, he did say thank you, but he was also just kind of like, this is a thing that you want to be a part of. Like, this is the experience that you will never forget. And everyone that you interview is just like, we definitely did not forget it. Most of us quit movie stuff after because it was really fucking hard. But it was a great experience, you know. And that's and in, like, most of the film crew from this, they did quit after this movie. And I think that kind of goes a long way of how they also got their editing room.
Yes.
Too, you know,
yes.
Because they had to resplice everything. Hennenlotter had cut it himself in his bedroom, but it was like I can't think of the word. There was like a jump in the splice.
Oh.
So they had to resplice everything.
Wow.
You know, this is shot on 16 millimeter.
That's what I shot my movie on.
Yeah.
Which I was going to say, if you're thinking about budget-wise, like, that was his entire budget, was getting that film developed and stuff.
Yeah, it was.
Because we spent – people were like, you shot a film. Like, was that crazy? And I was like, no, we got the film, like, for basically next to nothing. But once you had to, like, actually get it, like – developed and get it telecinate, all that stuff, like, that's what cost a ton of money. That was
exactly.
Most of our budget, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Is getting it actually blown up and done. I mean, we edited it on digital, obviously, but, like, you know, I can't even imagine. That's his budget. That's $30,000.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about that kind of budget, dealing with not having a lot of resources to make what you're making. Okay, we'll be right back.
Are stacks of unread books taking over your apartment?
Do you constantly miss your train stop because you're caught up in reading?
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
We party hard.
And by party hard, we mean read books.
So join us every Thursday on Reading Glasses, a Maximum Fun podcast about reading and book culture.
Get more out of your reading life.
We'll help you conquer your to-be-read pile.
Get out of that book slump.
And squeeze more reading time into your busy day.
Learn how to read better.
Wow, that was good.
And welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here today with Bria Grant talking about Basket Case. Okay, every single person who worked on this set has very fond memories of going dumpster diving for props, which is like something that they did every single night. They all went dumpster diving. Even a little girl who's 7 years old, like one of the daughters of the people who are working, who is Kika, she said that like one of her first memories is like doing that. She also puppeteered Bilal. They had a 7 year old girl puppeteering Bilal in the part where he like murders Dwayne's girlfriend.
Oh, amazing. Oh, wow. In that part, that's very, wow.
She was hiding.
Where is she now? Where's that girl now?
She's not okay? Making movies. She's totally okay. But she like, when she looks back, she's like, oh my God, what was I doing? Yeah.
What were her parents? Whatever. I mean, I'm sure she's like rad. I'm sure she's like real well adjusted or not.
Yeah, her whole family was helping with
it. Amazing.
And like even her grandfather had a cameo role in it. It was like a drunk guy walking out of a bar that got cut or something. So it was just kind of like, oh, this is like a family art project that we're doing. And it turned out to be Basket Case.
That's amazing.
I love having seen this after watching some interviews with people from the cast and knowing this, I love watching Basket Case and knowing what they dumpster dived for.
Tell me.
Because everything that you see is in it lends of an authenticity to the film that had they just had someone going out like an actual props master and like finding this stuff, and like, I just don't think it would have been the best. Like, there is a dead plant that's on a dresser or something that I remember where you're just like, oh, yeah, people have dead fucking plants. Like, that's
true.
Yeah. So there's just kind of like, it's an authenticity that's like gritty and weird. And he's portraying these characters who don't have much. And and to me, that, you know, like it does make it seem more credible when you're just, you know, picking stuff off the street. It's like, that's what I would do. Like, when I didn't have much stuff, I just picked it off the street. You know?
I mean, I still do that.
Exactly.
But we're also carrying peanut butter sandwiches around film festivals, so I don't know what that means about us. I will say, for my movie, she did everything, all the set deck, all the props. This one girl's amazing. She didn't have anything. And her main place she would go is Goodwill and the dollar store, because she felt like those places, she was on a budget, but also because she felt like they gave things more, things weren't IKEA. They weren't, because I feel like you see a lot of, especially like low budget movies right now, and people just go to IKEA and all the shit kind of looks the same.
Exactly, yes.
And you could just go to a Goodwill and get like an old looking TV and like a torn up couch for the same amount of money, or probably less, and have like a more unique take on what things look like.
Yeah, and it's a weird thing with indie films now, because we've done this now where the going trend is to buy something and then return it when the production is over.
So true.
And so, you know, people want to buy new things, and it's harder to sell those things back when you go to Goodwill. But the results of what you get are actually better, I think, if you get something used.
I totally agree, because then it's just going to look more unique. Because the things we remember from movies are not the, like, IKEA table. It's, like, the stuff that, like, that dresses the world that looks more authentic. Unless, I guess, you live in an IKEA house, and then maybe that is what your house, your world totally looks like. Just so you know, I still buy stuff for auditions sometimes and then return it.
Hey, I think people should know that, like, the Los Angeles economy is there's a lot of returns happening here.
So many returns, and they will, like the little hint for people making indie movies, if you return more than a certain amount, they will be like, that you have to like either return it on different days, or like if you buy like four sizes of the same shirt, or the same shirt in four sizes, they'll try to figure out if this was for a movie,
and
they'll try to like not take it back. And certain places will take anything back, and that's kind of amazing.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, you can even like return to stuff to Sephora that you've been using for a month. Even if you're never going to use it again.
This is a new podcast idea of Bria's frugality.
It's really true. I will try to return anything. Actually, I have stuff in my car to return today.
I feel like you and Henenlotter would get along.
We would just be such
really well.
I recently returned some vitamins, gummy vitamins that melted in my car because they were gummies, and I was like, I should pay like $40 for these. They're so expensive. And I took them. CVS was like, yeah, we'll take those back. And I was like, what a wonderful institution you're running here.
Oh my God. I have to say, this is, we should bring up the fact that, like, I do think you would get along with Henenlotter. Henenlotter is a person who also decided to eschew Hollywood concerns.
Great.
He could have made a career. He could have come out here and he could have worked with Roger Corman and launched his career like so many other filmmakers had.
Yeah.
But he did not. He just wanted to make his own films, like, for himself.
And that's amazing.
Yeah. I want to get into a couple of things before we go. One is nudity in films.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in exploitation and horror. Because there is an expectation for these films, especially exploitation, that there will be some kind of nudity. You kind of have to hit these check marks.
Yeah.
You know, like what you're exploiting. And you know, Henenlotter does that here. He hits the check marks, but then he puts his own kind of spin on these things.
Yeah.
The first nude scene that we get, I think, is actually Van Hentenrijk running nude through a darkened New York City
street.
Yeah,
there's a bouncing dong happening.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So there's bouncing dong in this movie. Mm-hmm. Is the first nudity you see. And that actually wasn't even in the script. It was supposed to be Bilal running, but they couldn't get the puppet to work in the right way.
Yeah.
And so then Henenlotter had to call him late at night and be like, hey, do you mind running naked through the street?
What are you wearing right now?
Yeah, Van Hentenrijk was just like, yeah, that's fine. That's great. I get it.
Yeah, what an awesome actor, though. But, like, it was like, yeah, dude, I'll totally run.
Yeah, it's totally fine. That's great.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
You want full bush? I'm out. I'm in.
That's the thing, you know, like, so, Henenlotter does have the female nudity in here. Like, we've got Terry Susan Smith. What is her name? She is
a real name.
She's wonderful. She was in a punk band, which is why she's wearing a wig and because her head was shaved.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I found this out because I was like, why is this woman wearing this horrible wig the entire movie? I wonder what band she was in. Do we know?
Oh, I actually wrote it down and then forgot what it was.
Okay.
I'm not going to
look
through
it. I'll look it up.
And I couldn't find any recordings of it.
Oh, okay. So not a band I would have liked.
Yeah, yeah, I looked. He does deliver that nudity, but it's in different ways, you know? Like, how do you feel about nudity in film? How, you know, have you had to bare yourself? Do you feel comfortable with that? Like, is there certain directors, certain stories that you're more comfortable with it?
Yeah, you know what's weird? As I've gotten older, I feel more comfortable with it, but I'm asked to do it less. Because when I was like 20, I didn't start acting until I was in my mid-20s. So when I was like 25, maybe, was around the time I got like my first role. And then by the time I was like 26, 27, I was on Heroes.
Yeah.
That's television, so you're not asked to do, I mean, at that time, now there's so many boobs on television. Yeah, I'm all about, like, people doing what they feel comfortable with, like, for their art and what they think is what it would be. Look, people, like, running naked through the street, that's, like, a dream you might have. If you're not comfortable doing it, I would, like, never ask an actor to do that. And I have been asked to do things that I wasn't comfortable with, and I said no.
Mm-hmm.
even, like, I've had, like, the horrible, like, we're shooting, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and you get a knock on your trailer, and they're like, hey, for this scene, we were thinking you would answer the door just, like, completely, like, half naked. And I was like, what? Why would I answer the door
half
naked?
Why would I do that?
And also, it's too late for me to call my agent. So, like, I'm, like, in this weird, and, you know, so I just said no, which is hard to do. I actually, like, I say that, like, it's so easy, but at the time, I remember being really tough, and I feel bad for, especially actresses who are, like, 18, where, like, you're just not... You maybe just don't feel totally comfortable saying no because you're like, will I ever have another opportunity to be in a movie? Will they fire mm-hmm. me? Like, that kind of thing. So I think as long as it's, like, not done under duress, there are moments for nudity. I like seeing boobs. I like seeing dong. I like seeing that in my movies. And especially if it, like, is a realistic you know, you're having
sex. It
feels
natural or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, when I have sex, I usually am naked. You know, like,
what?
Call me crazy.
Whoa, TMI, Bria. TMI.
But, I mean, I have never, like, had a moment where I was like, I really should be naked for this role. But I have, like, had moments where I was like, let me just be in my – I should be in my underwear. Like, why are we trying to, like, make me not in my underwear? So that's, like, sort of, like, where I've gone with this kind of stuff. But – I think it's just dependent on the movie. And, like, for this kind of movie, it is a little bit, like, people do expect it, I guess. I mean, yeah. You know way more about this than I would know.
I mean, yeah, there's – if you don't
How
have –
How do you feel about it?
Well, you know, I go back and forth on it. Exploitation films are something that I adore. And something, you know, I wanted to talk to you about that in general. Of just it's something that you can love even as you know that it's problematic. And I know
right.
that a lot of our listeners feel the same way.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, movies that were made 1970s through, 1980s, where there was a lot of exploiting women and making that the storyline.
Right, right.
And so it's hard because it's something that you grow up watching and
yeah,
it becomes
yeah.
kind of normalized in a way. But I tend to enjoy the other parts of these movies so much more. You
right.
know?
And I guess my question is always like, I'm bothered by the nudity, but then I'm like cheering on the violence. And like, so like,
yeah, what is wrong
like,
with me?
What is, yeah, this is definitely, and this is also how we grew up. I don't know if people like, you know, who are growing up right now will have like a different feeling about it.
Yeah.
But that is sort of how I feel where I'm like, oh, too much. Like it, people go too wild sometimes with the nudity. But for the most part, it doesn't like super bother me unless, I mean, I guess we've found out since like in all these, like with the nice/horrible thing about Time's Up and Me Too is that we get to hear all these stories where these women are like, no, I was coerced into doing this.
Yes.
Shit.
Yeah.
And that's like horrifying to hear. And I've been in situations where it could have easily happened to me as well. But then I talked to people. Actually, I asked Barbara Crampton about this once, and I don't know if she talked about this on your show, but she said, well, she would be naked in this scene. So I was naked. You know, like, that
yeah.
would, like, didn't even cross her mind. And I'm like, right, of course, because you're, like, a fucking artist, and this is, like, what you feel is right for you. So I think knowing what's right for you is really important, but it adds a lot of politics to the movie when you're thinking about how do you know what these people are feeling? How did that woman feel?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how she felt.
Yeah.
She was in a punk band, so I don't know.
Yeah. From all accounts, it seemed like she was fine with it. And then it was kind of like, well, I mean, if Van Hentenricks is going to get naked, then I'm going to, you know, like, whatever. Like, everyone kind of knew what they were in for.
Right.
And what that meant, like, doing a movie like this. And... But, you know, there is something about, like, the nudity and violence where it is so over the top in Henlotter's films that there's no way to take it seriously
yeah.
and that there's no way to find the nudity sexy.
You know what? And that's actually...
And that's something I enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, and I think as an actress, I would feel way more comfortable with non-sexy nudity than sexy nudity.
Yeah.
Like, I would much rather, like... be like, yeah, like running through the streets with my top off on accident. Like, that would be hilarious. Like, you know, something that's like more humorous. Or, I can't remember what movie it is, but there's a movie where Julianne Moore is like having a fight with her husband and she's changing while it's happening. And it's this moment where, and I think she gets naked and because she's like changing, she has on some like really unattractive, like pantyhose.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
like, you're like, and it's this like, oh, right, because you do walk around naked and have fights with your like significant other or anybody and look crappy, but it's also...
Oh, yeah, that's yeah. Shortcuts, I think.
Shortcuts, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. But yeah, she's like looking... You get... I'd be much more comfortable with that type of nudity than like a sexy, like, here I am in my whipped cream bikini or
yeah.
whatever. You know?
And, you know, perhaps that's why Henlotter to me is one of the best exploitation directors, you know, like, and that's one of the reasons why even Frankenhooker is so problematic. It still has this really strong and strange female lead.
Right.
Who gets her own kind of revenge. And, you know, it's
yeah.
something about it. And it's just not sexy. It's
yeah.
not sexy at all.
Yeah.
Even though it's about, you know, prostitutes. And it's not sexy one bit. We know who the villain is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not the women, you know.
Right. And I think a lot of the, like, even, like, newer horror movies, they have a lot of, like, sexy sex scenes in them. Which I'm just, like, less interested in those. I just... Cut those out and cut right to the violence for me, please. Thank you.
I mean, we've talked about this a little bit before, a little bit on our Fatal Attraction show, that it was it's extremely difficult to do a good sex scene in general.
Oh, gosh.
So trying to shoehorn that into something else, it's not good filmmaking off of them. And that's a problem where it's just like, if it's not serving the story,
it's not
even titillating people.
Yes.
You know, that's the thing. Like, it's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. It's just like something that someone thought should be there.
Exactly. I think, and that's the problem. By the way, shooting sex scenes is like the worst. Like when you're supposed to be being sexy. I just shot this movie and there's a part where I have an orgasm and it's just on my face and my boyfriend is like going down on me. And the set happened to have like a lot of young men that had just graduated from college. And at some point I was just like doing this and it's just me and like, you know, there's nothing. It's just obviously,
like
no one's really like going down on me, obviously. Just a close-up of my face. And at some point, I was like, I'm sorry, could I get more 22-year-old men in this room? It's going to make it a lot easier for me. And they were all like, didn't know what to do. Like, I could tell they were like, do I leave? Do I go? Like, because you're just like, it's so uncomfortable. Like, it's just, it's already really awkward. And then you just have a bunch of like 22-year-old boys staring at your face. I'm like, this is the least sexy orgasm I've fake orgasm I've ever had.
Bria, if you could have any closing thoughts on Basket Case, what are those?
Oh, man. Closing thoughts. I mean, I don't know. I think it's a very... It's just a fun movie. It is a shocking movie. I think in a lot... Like, things happen, you're like, wow, they went there. They did that crazy thing. And I like that they just went for it. They're like, let's have this crazy... I have this crazy idea. It's just a brother in a basket.
They just wanted to have fun, and that's why Hedonata wrote it.
I love it.
He wanted to write something that wouldn't have sequels, is what he said. That would be so off the wall that no one would ever ask him to make sequels.
Yeah, and you know what? I think that filmmaking should be fun, and I like that people embrace... I love when people embrace that, and we embrace corny, and we embrace hokey, and we embrace ridiculousness. Like, that is really fun for me, and part of something I really love about filmmaking. I do love serious movies. I love movies with a message. Sometimes I want to watch, like, you know, somebody's twin just, like, scratch a lady's face off or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Thank you so much for visiting me, Bria. Is there anything that you need to plug?
Just Dead Night. It's out in theaters and on VOD. And I think it's on, like, Hulu and Amazon as well. I don't know where all it is.
Thank you so much for coming today.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.